exponent, then also we see that we control this exponent. This is some universal number, more or less, of order 1. So this also will not matter. And also we can very easily compute the second norm, because these are just orthogonal random variables. They are independent at mean 0. So this is just given by square root n alpha beta. So when we look at the ratio, we see that this is exactly what is the upper estimate. So this is very simple to see that the estimate cannot be improved. But proving that we can get such estimate is a little harder. So this will be the main part of the talk. Now, the main tool we'll use for proving this estimate is the inequality coming from the joint work with Rafał Latała. And we prove the following thing. Let's take any p from 1, 2, a real function on two-point set minus alpha beta. And now we consider a measure mu, which is just distribution gives probability beta to minus alpha and probability alpha to beta. And expectation e mu is just with respect to this measure. So the following inequality holds. That's e mu f squared minus pth moment in power 2 by p can be estimated from above by some constant times the discrete gradient squared. F beta minus f minus alpha is just growth of the function, and this can be considered as discrete gradient. And we give exact form of this constant C alpha p, and what is quite surprising, this is optimal constant. This is maybe not very clear from the first side, but this is so. And to see that this constant C alpha p in this inequality is optimal, it's easy. You just plug in f minus alpha equal to alpha in power 2 by p, and for f in point beta, you plug in beta in power 2 by p, and you just check that the equality holds in this case. So this is easy. Now, how to prove that really the inequality holds? So first we do the following. We consider function phi y divided as 1 plus square root of y in power p plus 1 minus square root of y in power p and everything in power 2 by p. And this is for is the axis size. So now we know that phi is strictly convex. So now we just can draw the graph of this function phi, strictly convex, and we can support this in any chosen point by a straight line, and we can write inequality that this function is larger than the linear function supporting the graph of. We do this at the particular point y0, being beta in power 1 by p minus alpha in power 1 by p divided by the sum of these numbers squared. And when we write down this inequality and do some algebraic computation, purely algebraic, after more or less 10 up to 15 minutes, you will get that this is exactly the inequality we are looking for. At least I cannot do it faster, so computation, but well, I did it several times, so I hope this is correct. Okay, so now let's reformulate this inequality. By the way, it seems that this is quite strong inequality. One of the reasons I believe it's strong is that as a consequence, but also one can get, for example, logarithmic Sobolev inequality for two-point random variable very easily from this. Just divide both sides of this inequality by 2 minus p and take the limit with p tending to 2. Then one gets the optimal constant in logarithmic Sobolev inequality for two-point random variable, for example. But this inequality seems much stronger than logarithmic Sobolev. I will try to explain this during the proof that it works in a way better, at least in this situation, than logarithmic Sobolev. Okay, so now let's reformulate this inequality. We'll write it in the following form. Instead of the squared gradient, we'll write this as expectation of f times L of f, where L is a linear operator defined as function minus expectation of this function. This is a very trivial operator, and let me remind again that we still are on the two-point space, so this is quite abstract nonsense to write it this way. Of course, I will tensorize this later and use this in real product space situation. And, okay, so this is just about this logarithmic Sobolev consequence when you take p tending to 2. And I think this is due to Rothaus, but many people independently in different times proved this inequality, so now it's hard to say who was. Yes?
No,
the previous.
Of course, between the 2 and 1, you will have the same problem, 1 over alpha to power.
This is quite difficult. Between 1 and 2, it's simple, but between 1 and p, this is quite difficult situation, and I will say a few words about this.
Then 1 should go to 0 also.
Yes. This is quite delicate. Okay, so... just a moment. It's clear that this is the same. This expression is just variance of function f, as one can easily see from this form. So this is easy to check that this is just formulation. Okay, so now when we have this operator L being identity minus expectation, we can ask what good properties this trivial operator. It has quite many good properties. First, it's a self-adjoint operator on this measure space with natural measure. It has two eigenvalues. It cannot have more. Zero is eigenvalue with eigenfunction being constant. And one is eigenvalue with eigenfunction being identity. So function which is minus alpha in minus alpha and beta in beta. And also we can generate in a trivial way non-negativity preserving semigroup. So what is this e in power minus tl? Here we have just bounded operator because we live on finite space. So this can be just done by developing this in informal power series and everything makes sense even without going to NS. Functional analysis to semigroup theory. And what does non-negativity preserving property mean? That when we take non-negative function on this two-point set, then after taking this semigroup in power minus TL operator on F, we'll still have non-negative function. And this is very easy to check that this function has this property. Operator L has this property. Okay, so now we need one technical observation. Then for each p between 1 and 2, this constant C alpha p, which appears in the inequality, is not greater than alpha times beta. So we'll need to be sure that this coefficient cannot be larger than 1. We'll need. So why this is so? We know that this constant C alpha p is optimal constant in our functional inequality, so we can write it just as a supremum over all non-constant function of such expression. And now when we look at the nominator of this expression, this is clearly non-decreasing in p. So just because the p-th moment is growing with the growth of p. And therefore... this expression clearly is also non-decreasing in p, non-increasing because, we take minus here. And therefore, C alpha p will be not greater than C alpha 1, which is exactly alpha times beta. Okay, so now let's take another property of operator L. Now we'll write square root of 1 minus C alpha p divided by alpha beta times L. This is why we needed to know that this is not greater than 1, because otherwise this operator would be not defined. And we define such operator, and we write it down as in the form of semigroup, e in power minus T alpha p over L. And T alpha p is a real number chosen that so that e in power minus T alpha p is just square root of 1 minus this constant divided by alpha beta. And why this is so? Well, L has spectrum consisting just of 0 and 1, and this is self-adjoint operator, so you just check, you plug instead of L 0 and 1, and you check that this equality holds. So this is again trivial. So, now start the proof of the main theorem. Okay, so again we use the lemma, we reformulated lemma, and now we can put this C alpha P divided by alpha beta L part to the left hand side and this Pth moment to the right hand side. So this is equivalent formulation of lemma. And now we can write the left hand side as a L to norm of this square root of 1 minus C alpha P divided by alpha beta L on F. Right? We are just using the trivial identity. And we can take square root of both sides. So this means just that this operator, which we know that we can form, this e in power minus t alpha p l on f, has norm as operator acting from lp into l2, not great, because we know this, taking the conjugate exponent q, so that 1 by p plus 1 by q is 1. We know that then the adjoint operator, but this will be the same operator because L was self-adjoint. So this semigroup is also self-adjoint. And this will be also contraction as acting from L2 into LQ. Okay, so now we define a new operator, but now it will be quite reasonable because it will act on the product space. So we take L double L F, define this as let me first explain this in a quite heuristic way. Imagine that operator L was not as we defined it, but just like taking derivative. So this operator in that case would be just the sum of partial derivatives over all n variables. And this is exactly what happens in our case. In formal way, we can write it down using the tensor version, but what we do is the following. We fix all values, all arguments except the first one. Then we take operator L on this function, treat it as a function of one argument, and then we let all other arguments loose, getting again the function of n arguments. This is basically what's going on. So this is just taking this operator L partially on each of the n coordinates. And now we have some observations. First, this double L is again self-adjoint. This is very easy to check. On the constant function, on this product space, it will be just zero. On any linear functional, it will be again this linear functional. This is very easy. You just write this in linear functional in coordinates, and this follows from the fact that identity was eigenfunction with eigenvalue 1 of operator L, with which we started. And also it's easy to check that such semigroup preserves negativity. Well, let me say about some easy criterion. Semigroup on some finite space, then to check that this semigroup preserves non-negativity is equivalent to check that if in some point alpha, say A, f of A is the same as maximum of the function f, then the operator L on f in point A should be non-negative. This is easy to prove that in finite, when everything acts on finite space, this is equivalent. This is a well-known fact from the semigroup theory. And this is just this set minus alpha beta is finite, and to check that this holds is trivial, because if f is maximum, global maximum of f, then it's also maximum in each coordinate separately, and then each of li operators on f will be non-negative, because this is function minus expectation of function, so of course this will be non-negative in maximum point. So this is very easy to check in this way, but if you don't like this proof, you just write what e in power minus t double L is, And you can formally prove this without doing these tricks. So this is also easy. Okay, now there is a little harder fact that if we have that this e in power minus t alpha pl is contraction from L2 into LQ, then we know the same for this double L. This is so-called hypercontractivity. And this is done just by simple induction. If you know how to do this for n equal 2, then by simple induction you can go to general n. And to do that, you just use the fact that, well, that these two things commute. This is one of the facts which we use. And the second fact is just triangle inequality, Minkowski inequality for the norm 2 divided by Q, which is larger than 1. But I don't want to get into technical details. This is quite standard. How to pass from L to the... Okay, so now we get that such inequality holds for arbitrary function f. And now we just resign from taking an arbitrary function and we get a particular function given by the following formula. F of x, where x has just n coordinates in the set minus alpha beta in power n, is given by the norm of sum of vectors vi up to vn with coefficients x1 up to xn. So, of course, when we have a norm on a linear space, then there exists a sequence of linear functionals such that this norm is just supremum over this sequence of linear functionals. This is a well-known geometric fact, more or less Hahn-Banach theorem. And then let's denote by fk taking one of these linear functionals giving the norm on the sum xi, vi, and so on. So we can write it down again in the form of linear functional on the vector x, and these are just real coefficients now. Okay, so we know that this is linear functional, and we know that f is a supremum of such family of linear functionals. And we know that our semigroup is non-negativity preserving. So what we know? We know that this is larger than this, just because f was larger than each of these fk's. And if we have non-negativity preserving, then semigroup preserves all inequalities between functions. This is just a consequence of linearity and non-negativity preserving. Now, we know that linear functionals are eigenfunctions with eigenvalue 1 of this semigroup. So we just know exactly what this is. This is just e in power minus t alpha p fk for linear functional fk. And now, again, we know exactly what e in power minus t alpha p was because we just chose this number so that we could control this. This was chosen so that e in power minus t alpha p is square root of 1 minus this constant divided by alpha beta. Okay, and now we have this inequality, and we have this inequality for any k, so we can take supremum over all k's, and what we get is exactly this inequality. In, know that this is non-negative because f is given by the norm. So this is just non-negative function. So we can put it under the Q's norm. It's inequality. This norm function is times Q's norm. And this is exactly the KQ as this constant reversed, and this is exactly the inequality we are proving. I will not give you the proof that this really is of the right order. Let me following order of magnitude. These values are the same. This is just elementary calculations to check this. This. Okay, so that's basically the proof. I'd like to how much time I have? Thank you. question would be what are the possible applications of this? I didn't work on this having any applications in mind, as I said, but after all, I realized that this can have some applications in combinatorics, because the situation here we have values minus alpha beta, but by constant we go to the 0, 1 random variables. And so let me formulate this in the following way. Let's say that we have vi xi. By the way, here I started with x and I formulated the theorem also for y's, but this is very easy if you get this theorem for random variable x. It's easy to get this for copies of symmetrizations yi. So this is a standard way to pass from one to another. These are just equivalent formulations. And now, in of taking only the linear terms, we can ask about the following. Let's take so-called chaos of order 2. And this will denote as F. And now the question is what we can say about Q's norm of S. And it can easily be shown, of course, here you can, instead of taking the chaos of degree 2, take the chaos of degree k. So, in the end, we will have, and here product. By that. So this is chaos of degree. Now, and then for such chaos, the inequality can be proved in a standard way. This is very well known that when you have such hypercontractive bands, it can be obtained also in this way. You just have this constant in power k. And in fact, something more can be proved. What can be proved is the following, that you can vector W here, and again we are working with chaos of degree k, the following thing. Let it write in the following way. And we just add factor k, q, to each summand in the power being the number of these copies of x multiplied. So here we'll have kq in power k.
Shape is product of two.
Yeah.
V1 to
yes. And here we have and norm. So, of course, you can replace kq here by any larger constant, but then you must remember about putting the same whenever x1, say, here 1 and here, instead of kth power, it will be just the product of. With this constant. But what is the point of this? Of course, usually it's not very easy to deal with case when we take just real coefficients. the second norm of such expression. So for some purpose of combinatorial things, one can use this for estimating the tails of such sums. However, it seems that this is not very effective. Well, this kind of estimates for chaoses works the best when the chaos is just the product of the situations in which the inequality was working well in the beginning. We had equality just for the one vector case, then the chaos for which it will work optimally will be just chaos based on of k copies of a random variable, and then we'll get equality for chaos. If there was n, then we'll have just the chaos of the following form: x1 plus xn, where n was this number of copies which gave equality, and here just independent copies of these random variables, and again, and everything k times. And for such products, the inequality will work with almost equality there. And somehow it seems that this case just doesn't appear naturally in combinatorial setting. So this is one of the reasons these estimates one gets in combinatorics from these are, at least they seem to me quite weak compared to what you get by other methods. Okay, and now back to Vitaly Milman's question about what happens for the p. I proved a few years ago the following theorem. Say x1, xn symmetric independent random variables. Real random variables, then the following holds. You denote S some xi vi. Vi is a vector from some normed space, and then the following holds. So you can estimate the second norm of S by the maximum over square root of 2 infinity norm. So infinity norm of the random variable is just its range, the essential supremum. And so here we have just the second norm, times the first norm of S. So if you take as xi, y, taking values 1 and minus 1 with probability alpha, and 0 with probability close to 1, then you will get optimal constant between the second and and this constant will be exactly what you would expect. Because this gives good asymptotics in R. That I completely don't have idea what would be the optimal constant between Qth and first moment. I don't know this. Of course, in some case, when Q is less than logarithm 1 over alpha, this will be 1 over alpha in power 1 minus 1 over Q, as one could expect. This is just because you can put together this inequality between second and first moment, and this inequality, because equality holds in the same case of just one random vector. But then, for Q larger than the logarithm of 1 over alpha, you cannot put these two inequalities together in a good way. Of course, you can put them, but the constant will be far from optimal. And what I suppose that for logarithm 1 over alpha q, for such range, and this is easy to check. So this is basically the same. So of Q, this just doesn't matter when you take this root. It's comparable to 1, so it doesn't affect the. And then there is phase transition. alpha logarithm 1 over alpha. But this is just guess. So it's easy when you plug this in. This shows that this cannot be improved, but whether such inequality holds at all, I don't know. So these are just guesses. And the guesses are based on the fact it's quite the only I really checked this and maximize over n only in the case where these coefficients are equal to 1, all of them. I wasn't even able to check this on all real. This is some nice analytical question, and if you have a student who likes to calculate a lot and needs to write a master thesis, probably it will be like 50 pages long. Just to give you a flavor, I will write the formula due to Rafał Latała showing what is the piece, and I will end on this. This is quite elementary to prove what happens in the case of equal coefficients. And this is more or less of the size. N, if N is less than P divided by logarithm 1 over alpha. Then it's alpha N in power 1 by P if N is between P divided by logarithm 1 over alpha and E in power minus P divided by alpha. Then it's P divided by 1 plus logarithm P divided by N alpha if maximum over these two, P and logarithm over alpha and E in power minus P by alpha is less than N, which is less than P by alpha. How it looks. And finally, there will be square root of N P alpha if N is larger than P by alpha. So this is nice formula just in the case of equal coefficients. So we can imagine basically what the formulas are for arbitrary coefficients. Just using some Orlich norms, and this can be computed in the case of some regular sequences like, say, k in some power or something like that. But I don't like dealing with such horrors, and still you need to maximize this over all possible real coefficients to estimate these things. So somehow I don't see how to transfer this to other comparison of moments.
This connection is of method with Babcock proof of Gaussian. When you go to pool and temperature, or it is absolutely disconnected.
But what does his proof about? What does Babcock proof about Gaussian?
His proof of Gaussian.
You mean the discrete?
Yes.
Using this function u and so on. No, I don't see any connection.
Two-point theorem, but for Rademacher.
You know, tensorization is the same tool, but. Tensorization is the same tool, but...
You perhaps did not do, but it would be very interesting, I believe, to check Rademacher-type projection estimate for this variable. Perhaps this is the right approach for non-symmetric case, which stops.
Maybe. I'm just too weak in this convex geometry things, but maybe some of the other... Well, also the questions about type and cotype for such random variables may be interesting. But somehow I think that there was a good reason why Rademachers were used. It's just much easier to deal with them. And let me say just one last thing. Here, the map on N depending strongly on Q and and alpha. So it's completely different situation than for Rademachers. For Rademachers, the limit was, the good constant was when you were just taking N going to infinity. And here it will be spoiled by a very big factor if you take just N going to infinity. It's completely different phenomenon. So in a way, this explains why Rademachers are nicer. They give some joint treatment.
for non-symmetric bodies, they don't work. Perhaps something like this is.
Go ahead.
How do the
inequalities change
when n tends to the limit theorem, because you can just use central limit theorem, and then the constant will be just the second moment, which in this case is square root of 1 over alpha, times the square root of q, more or less, right? But then you need to divide this by the second moment, right, of this expression. And in this case, it will be just square root of 1 over alpha, right? So this will give more or less square root of q, as in the case of Rademachers, because you have the same central limit theorem for Rademachers and for this real random variables, right? So there is no hope of getting anything besides square root of q. And here you have this big factor. Of course, logarithm is not so important, but this square root of 1 over alpha is what really matters. This is a different situation.
Any other? Okay.